If I could have your attention, please. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome this afternoon to the World Affairs Council luncheon. My name is Clyde Hutchins, Vice President and Board Member of Alaska World Affairs Council. And to get started, please silence your cell phones so we don't get any interruptions today. Okay. Are there any students here today? I don't believe I see any. Oh, there we go. And you're from the university? All right. Great. You're from the University of Alaska. I also like to recognize the Honorary British Counsel, Dee Dee Hitchens. She's here today. Would you please stand? All right. Thank you. All right. As you all know, you're enjoying a great lunch here, and we have a great event here on a Thursday. Our luncheons are usually Friday, but now we're getting two events this week, and I think a lot of that's due to the Hong Kong Economic and Trade Office, who's been very generous in helping us to put on this event, providing the luncheon, so we'd like to give a round of applause to that organization. And I'd like to thank William Thurer and Michael Cook. They record the program today. The Alaska World Affairs Council presents a podcast, which is a recording of this event, will be available online at kska.org. Early next week, today's program will be available that you can download on the KSKA Public Radio website. And you just go to kska.org and search for AWAC Presents. Now tomorrow we have a speaker, Mr. Whitman, and he has written a book about international art thefts. He's was with the FBI, and his book is at the table. So if you want to take a look at that before tomorrow's meeting and maybe read up a little bit, it's a great book. It's very absorbing, and I encourage you to check it out. Now at the head table we have Commissioner Donald Tong, and seated next to. There's my seat. And then over there is, we have, now we have Garrett Wong. He's a board member. And then next to him is Dr. Paul Dunscombe, a board member. And then at the very end, we have Jeff Leong, director of the Hong Kong Economic and Trade Office. Now, Garrett Wong will be introducing the speaker. And Mr. Wong.
Thank you, Clyde. Well, it's my pleasure today to introduce Commissioner Tong. Mr. Donald Tong Chiu Kyung was born in Hong Kong, and he graduated from the Chinese University of Hong Kong in 1983 and joined the Hong Kong Civil Service in the same year. In 2008, Mr. Tong assumed the post of the Hong Kong Commissioner for Economic and Trade Affairs, USA. This organization promotes U.S.-Hong Kong economic trade ties. He also oversees the work of three Hong Kong economic and trade offices in the cities of Washington, D.C., New York, and San Francisco. Prior to this appointment, he was Deputy Secretary for Home Affairs. Additionally, he's held several government offices, including being the Deputy Secretary of the Environment. Finally, Mr. Tong served as the first secretary in the Hong Kong Economic and Trade Office in Washington, D.C. Today, Donald will speak to us on Hong Kong, a destination and gateway to China. So please, a warm Alaska World Affairs Council applause and welcome to Commissioner Tong to the podium. Donald?
Thanks, Clyde, and also Garrick, for the kind introduction and welcoming remarks. This is my first visit to Alaska, and I'm pretty sure that this will not be the last. I owe my family a promise. I made some 20 years ago that this will be the place for our summer vacation. I have yet to fulfill this promise, but I'm going to bring back with one message for my family, that Alaska, it's not white in summer. It actually is very green, just like any other U.S. cities. Before I come back, I'm going to send some of my colleagues out here again, because although we arrived last night, we do find that there are some interest in exporting water to Alaska water to Hong Kong, and there are also some companies who are interested looking in the possibility of setting up companies in Hong Kong. So we will be back later this year to help out these companies. I would first of all like to thank the World Affairs Council for putting together this luncheon opportunity for us to meet with new friends and also to talk about the latest developments in Hong Kong. The Hong Kong Economic and Trade Office is the official representative of the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region Government. Our key job is to strengthen the economic, trade, and cultural ties between the U.S. and Hong Kong. We do have, in addition to the headquarters in Washington, D.C., two offices, one in San Francisco and one in New York. Today with me, of course, is Jeff, who is the director of the San Francisco office. And then we also have Wendy Au, the deputy director of the San Francisco office. They are responsible for liaising with 19 states in the U.S. to the west of Mississippi River, including the state of Alaska. So if you are visiting Hong Kong and you want to establish business ties with Hong Kong, Jeff and Wendy would be very good contact points to start with. As you can imagine, I travel around the U.S. quite a bit. When I talk with workaday Americans, I'm always struck by how much Hong Kong people and Americans have in common. Both are fiercely entrepreneurial and independent mind. Both are abundantly optimistic and believe that tomorrow will be better than today because we can make it so. But one thing that I've noticed, some Americans I meet with are a bit unclear about how Hong Kong is doing in the present time frame, given the sweeping political developments since 1997. They ask me, are Hong Kong people enjoying the same degree of freedom like before the changeover in 1997? Are we still a free market economy? How is the U.S.-Hong Kong relationship in play? At times, you also receive interesting questions like, who would win in a fight? Bruce Lee or Jackie Chan? These are all very good questions, especially the last one, about the Hong Kong action heroes, Bruce Lee and Jackie Chan. I will give you my own personal view on that later, at the end of my remarks. States and cities could mean different things to different people, but there are certain foundational elements and universal truth about any great destination. See the word Alaska? People would associate with glaciers, Eskimos, seafood, Alaskan malamute, petroleum industry, and tourism. See the word Hong Kong, and many would easily associate that with a place where the East meets the West, world financial center, top tourist destination, wonderful food, shopping paradise, major trading hub. All these are, of course, correct depictions of the ever-dynamic Hong Kong. One major similarity between America and Hong Kong, we both have defied the critics. When America declared its independence from England, some in Europe doubt whether the U.S. would last but for a few years. Likewise, the history of Hong Kong is a tale about defying the critics. Let's rewind back a couple of hundred years. Hong Kong emerged from humble beginnings as a sparsely populated, largely mountainous terrain. It was once described as a barren rock, an uninviting prospect for settlement, let alone commerce. Hong Kong's greatest natural asset at the time was its sheltered deep water harbor, strategically situated on the trade routes between the East and the West. From this, Hong Kong blossomed into a hub of burgeoning trade conduit with the world. Although our geographic size is only 420 square miles, so you can actually fit five Hong Kong in Anchorage. and 1,300 Hong Kongs in the state of Alaska. That's how small we are. Then in the years running up to Hong Kong's handover to China in 1997, newspapers were reporting on the brain drain of Hong Kong, that the flight of the city's best and brightest would leave it an empty shell. How would Hong Kong ever survive after the handover to China? The pundits asked. At the time, Fortune magazine pronounced the death of Hong Kong and proclaimed that the city's future was summed up in two words: it's over. The article reported Hong Kong's role as a vibrant international commercial and financial hub was indisputably dying, and the city was destined to become a global backwater. To paraphrase the great Mark Twain, the report of our death has been greatly exaggerated. Today, Hong Kong is a teeming city of capitalism and an international financial trading and logistic hub. The pulse of 7 million people defines it as a modern metropolis, a triumph merging of great civilization and evidence of the benefits of the free trade. So why did we survive? Why did we thrive when many thought we wouldn't? I'd say a big part of our success rests in the foundation of our relationship with China under the principle of one country, two systems, as enshrined in our mini constitution, the Basic Law. That was a novel idea when it was first formulated. From an uncertain, untested model, it has become a reliable strength that allows for Hong Kong's high degree of autonomy. One country, two systems principle preserves cherished rights and freedoms in Hong Kong, like freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and the free flow of ideas, information, and capital. Civil liberties and internet freedoms remain inextricably woven into economic liberties, with our commitment to the rule of law, which is the common thread running through them. Since the turnover to China, our laws are passed by our own legislature, the Legislative Council. Our common law system, inherited from the British, has been maintained, upheld by an independent judiciary, with the Court of Final Appeal maintained in Hong Kong, not in the mainland. We have a clean and highly transparent civil service. We have a vibrant media, which has proven itself to be a very effective watchdog over the government. And we have a full and active representation in international forums such as the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum and the World Trade Organization. Hong Kong continues to truly embrace a broad worldview. Hong Kong's adherence to these principles not only allows its citizens the freedom to exercise their entrepreneurial talents and to prosper, but it also grants the city the notable distinction of the world's freest economy. For 16 straight years, in fact, the Heritage Foundation and the Wall Street Journal has bestowed on Hong Kong this top spot. The World's Doing Business report has also crowned Hong Kong with the second runner-up spot among 183 economies in its 2010 round, indicating yet again the regulatory environment in Hong Kong is very conducive to business. Over the past 2 years, we have seen governments around the world take unprecedented steps to lessen the impact of the global economic crisis. Hong Kong is no exception, but we have been relatively resilient this time. Despite the downturn, our fundamentals have served well in weathering the crisis. Our banks remain solid and healthy, and there is no need for our government to inject capital into any banks to save them. To help our community ride out of the economic crisis, the Hong Kong government spent about $11 billion on economic stimulus measures. We've also taken steps to guarantee bank deposits, provide additional capital to the banking sector if required, and support small and medium enterprises. Fortunately, all our banks remain, as I said earlier on, very healthy. These measures have achieved their desired results. Signs of improvement began to emerge in Hong Kong from second quarter last year. although our GDP still dropped by 2.8% as a whole in 2009. The Hong Kong economy continued to show a broadly based recovery this year, benefit mainly from the robust growth momentum in the mainland and other Asian economies, and of course, the recovery of the US economy. Our GDP increased by 7.2% year on year in the first half this year. Our exports and imports increased by around 25% and 31% respectively in the first 7 months, year on year. Indeed, Hong Kong's merchandise exports have largely returned to levels prior to the outbreak of the economic crisis. Private consumption and investment spending also accelerate. Our unemployment rate has gradually dropped to the latest 4.3%. Last year, we also saw tourist arrivals reach a record high of 29.6 million. Continuing this growth trend, tourist arrivals ratchet up by nearly 25% to 20 million already in the first 7 months this year. We are most likely to set another record high this year. Although we expect slower growth in the second half this year due to uncertainties surrounding the European economies, we maintain an optimistic outlook and have lately revised our annual GDP growth forecast this year from 4 to 5% upwards to 5 to 6%. This is very much in line with the economic forecasts by International Monetary Fund, Asian Development Bank, and private sector economists. We do not take continuous economic growth for granted. As a highly externally oriented economy, Hong Kong must quickly adapt to changing market demands in order to remain competitive. We do so by strengthening our traditional four economic pillars, namely financial services, tourism, trading and logistics, and professional services, and nurturing new growth areas where we enjoy certain advantages. While Hong Kong itself is an attractive destination for our overseas trading partners, we realize the potential that the massive mainland market will continue to present for both Hong Kong and overseas businesses. As such, we are taking full advantage of our geographical proximity to the mainland, particularly the Pearl River Delta region, which alone has a 400 million population. We are working to intensify collaboration with the mainland on a range of areas, from economic integration and enhanced infrastructure links to environmental improvement and intellectual property protection. Our efforts will fortify Hong Kong's dual roles, serving both as a gateway for overseas investment into the mainland and as a platform for mainland companies to raise capital and enter international markets. In 2009, a daily average of around 41,000 vehicles and 470,000 people crossed between Hong Kong and the mainland border by land alone. And this is not monthly figure, this is daily figure. To meet the growing demand for people and cargo flows, we recently kicked off several major infrastructure projects. They will not only open up new markets in the mainland of China, but would also reduce cost and boost efficiency. Construction work on a massive 18-mile bridge connecting Hong Kong with Macau and Zhuhai in the western Pearl River Delta just commenced at the end of last year. Upon commissioning around 2016, it will substantially reduce the current 4-hour trip between Zhuhai and Hong Kong to less than 40 minutes. In addition, it will enable the western part of the Pearl River Delta to catch up with more vibrant eastern Pearl River Delta, fully realizing its economic potential to the benefit of mainland Hong Kong and the international business communities. In January this year, work also started on the Guangdong-Zhuhai-Hong Kong Express Rail Link. When completed in 2015, commuters could travel between the West Kowloon Terminus in Hong Kong and Guangzhou in the mainland in 48 minutes, as compared to the 100 minutes journey now. The link will also put Hong Kong on a map of China's high-speed rail link. In future, you will be able to travel from Hong Kong to Shanghai by rail in 8 hours and Beijing in 10 hours. To maintain the competitiveness of our container port, the third busiest in the world, We are now undergoing a feasibility study on developing a 10th container terminal. Hong Kong's airport is the busiest international air cargo hub in the world. To cope with the increasing demand for air cargo and passenger services, we are now expanding our air cargo handling capacity and considering the feasibility of adding a third runway. Another notable investment is the development of a world-class cruise terminal at the former Kai Tak Airport to capitalize on the budding cruise line business in the region. We are on target to commission the first berth and terminal building in 2013. To support the development of our arts and cultural center, Hong Kong is now developing a 100-acre cultural hub, the West Kowloon Cultural District, along our spectacular Victoria Harbour. We plan to develop no less than 15 arts facilities to enrich Hong Kong's art and cultural content for both locals and tourists. It will be our very own West End with a Broadway skyline. In addition to these mega projects, another key element of our economic strategy is to develop priority industries with the best potential for diversifying our economic base and creating jobs. We have identified six areas, namely testing and certification, medical services, innovation and technology, cultural and creative industries, environmental industry, and educational services. These industries are not new in Hong Kong, but what we are doing now is to create a more conducive environment to stimulate their further development so that they could better achieve their full potential. The government will provide more land resources, investment, infrastructure, and more training places to ensure adequate talent for these industries to thrive. For example, we have already identified six pieces of land for the development of self-financing tertiary institutions. They will provide more choices for our locals and afford external students, particularly those from the mainland, to pursue higher education in Hong Kong. To promote innovation and technology, we have put in place a $645 million Innovation and Technology Fund to provide funding support for applied R&D projects. We also introduced an R&D cash rebate scheme to give a cash rebate equivalent to 10% of investment in R&D projects to enterprises. Hong Kong has long maintained a level playing field, and we certainly welcome U.S. investment in these areas. While we develop these new growth areas, we have not forgotten that of the need to reinforce our existing pillars. I would like to focus on two particular areas, namely financial services and the closer economic partnership arrangement, or in short, CEPA, C-E-P-A. On financial services, we have recently been ranked as the third global financial center after London and New York by the City of London's Global Financial Centers Index. This is likely a result of a combination of factors including our prime location, high-speed communication, and free flow of information and capital. Last year, IPOs in Hong Kong raised the most out of the global stock exchanges. In addition to attracting mainland companies, American firms like Wynn Resorts and Las Vegas Sands have successfully conducted IPOs in Hong Kong. We also saw last year a breakthrough for our financial integration with the mainland. This includes the launch of a pilot scheme for renminbi trade settlement. Hong Kong banks on the mainland and foreign companies like McDonald's are allowed to issue renminbi bonds in Hong Kong. Renminbi raised can be repatriated to the mainland for investment purpose. So don't be surprised to see more McDonald's coming up when you visit mainland in the future. The Central People's Government in Beijing also launched its renminbi sovereign bonds in Hong Kong. To speed up our financial integration with the mainland, new measures that have not been attempted nationally will be implemented with our neighbors in Guangdong Province on an early and pilot basis. This will accelerate the two-way flow of financial institutions, financial products, capital and talent between Hong Kong and the Pearl River Delta. We shall also continue to streamline the two financial systems in Hong Kong and the mainland to become an even more efficient and low-risk corridor for investment into and out of the mainland. Last year, the mainland recorded 8.7% GDP growth, and it is expected to experience strong growth again this year. As a premier international gateway to the mainland, Hong Kong is well positioned to capitalize on our nation's economic growth. Hong Kong will also continue to play a particularly important role in the development of the neighboring Pearl River Delta area. We shall continue to break down barriers to cross-boundary trade and services and investment under our unique free trade agreement with the mainland, the Closer Economic Partnership Arrangement, CEPA. Under CEPA, Hong Kong businesses enjoy preferential market access in the mainland in 44 service sectors such as financial, logistic, and legal services. In addition, goods of Hong Kong origin are entitled to tariff-free entry into the mainland market. CEPA is nationality blind. Hence, overseas companies incorporated in Hong Kong, including American firms, can also enjoy its full benefits. The U.S. and Hong Kong have long enjoyed close ties. The U.S. is our second largest trading partner after the mainland. Last year, we import over $21 billion worth of goods from the U.S., making Hong Kong the U.S. 13th largest export destination. On a per capita basis, we import substantially more than from the U.S. than many other economies, including European Union, Japan, Mexico, and Brazil. We export only about $3.6 billion of goods in return to the U.S., so the U.S. did enjoy a trade surplus of over $17 billion with Hong Kong last year. So what about Alaska? We imported nearly $22 million worth of goods from Alaska, and we are now your 14th largest export destination. Key exports from Alaska to Hong Kong were computers and electronics, fishing, hunting, and trapping equipment. Many predicted that with the changeover and continuation of mainland's open door policy, Hong Kong will no longer serve as an attractive location for overseas business. This turns out to be incorrect. Nearly 1,300 American companies are now in Hong Kong, including over 800 serving as regional offices and headquarters. We believe that they are doing this because of the following Hong Kong advantages. Excellent geographical location. Within 5 hours flight time, you will be able to reach half of the world's population. And of course, our proximity to the mainland market. Our excellent airport and container port facilities. We have a clean and efficient government. A simple and no tax system. Personal income tax kept at 15%. And corporate profits tax at 16.5%. No VAT, and no capital gains tax, no sales tax, of course. Free flow of information, capital, and people, including visa-free entry for U.S. citizens. Rule of law with independent judiciary, and excellent protection for intellectual property rights. Last but not least, an educated and hardworking workforce who knows the mainland market very well. I hope this update on Hong Kong has succeeded in attracting you to visit us in future, and we look forward to welcoming you in Hong Kong, the city that never sleeps. Be sure that to allow yourself sufficient time to tour our scenic spots and to take full advantage of a shopping paradise, free of sales tax and VAT, and just make sure that you will be able to enjoy or sample the cuisines offered by our 12,000 plus restaurants. And don't forget duty-free wine. I promise you answer to a question on who would win, Bruce Lee or Jackie Chan. I have not forgotten that. I can't really tell. I'm partial to Jet Li. But I'm going to let Jackie Chan answer. In his autobiography, Jackie Chan said the following about Bruce Lee. I don't think I could have beaten him in a fight, and I wouldn't have been dumb enough to try. There you have it. Thank you.
Yes, time for a couple questions. Okay. If you have any questions from Commissioner Tong, he's going to take a few questions from the audience.
Yes.
Okay. And hold on, we have a microphone coming right to you.
Oh. why don't you just stop? Yeah, and then we pass the mic.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your talk, and I want to commend the Hong Kong people in developing such a vibrant city and economy. I was once in Hong Kong, looked at a shipyard where people were building a junk. There were 15 people working hard, and one person standing around with his hands in the pocket. You go to an American, say, road construction site, the ratio of people observing to workers would be quite a bit different, I think. But anyway, my question is about your tax system. The government here in this country uses tax policy to direct industrial development or economic activity in one way or another. And you mentioned your simple tax policy. How do you politically keep the pressure to vary that tax code and to make it as complicated as ours? You mentioned that it was simple and relatively low rates. How do you keep the politics from allowing that to change and making a tax code that it takes reams of paper to yep. Look at?
I think each economy has a different system, and with some elements which may work for us, but not necessarily for the U.S., and indeed vice versa is true. In Hong Kong, I think we benefit from a few things. Number one, we do not have a big defense budget. The mainland government pays for national defense. We don't have to pay for the stationing of the Chinese armies in Hong Kong, so that helps. But more importantly, Hong Kong is small. I mentioned earlier on that you could put we could put 5 Hong Kong in Anchorage alone. That's how small Hong Kong is. And because of this, and because we have 7 million people, and the population keeps increasing, so we actually derive quite a fair share of the government revenue from leasing government land for residential and commercial developments. So this actually gives us a very stable income stream. And that's the reason why we are able to keep the tax system simple. Some other economies, because I think they have a different tax system, so at times they would offer tax holidays. They would also deliberately reduce the tax rate in order to attract overseas investments. For Hong Kong, we do not do that, because we believe that Hong Kong's tax system is already attractive enough. And the last thing we want to do is to invite criticism or misunderstanding about Hong Kong serving as a tax haven. We don't want this connotation. And as the figures show, our system indeed works very well. And of course, in Hong Kong, we've been very lucky as well, because we have the population and we have the vibrant economic activity. So I am glad to say that most of the time, Hong Kong government has a surplus budget. We seldom have any deficit budget. Even last year, when we were going through a very difficult time, we still succeed in achieving a small budget surplus. For the time being, we still have like close to $70 billion in the government cover. So that can keep the government going without receiving, for 18 months, without receiving one single dollar in government revenue. But as I said earlier on, we don't take things for granted. And this is the reason why we keep on looking into new areas, new growth areas. I've been telling some of our friends out here in Anchorage and Alaska, it's almost like swimming upstream. If you do not keep up with your efforts, the chances that you'll be lagging behind, going downstream. Thanks.
My question is from the period before 1997, when the lease expired and the British military was stationed in Hong Kong. I years ago heard on a TV documentary that the British military charged the people of Hong Kong for their security services, and they even made a small profit, which is pretty amazing, because it seems to me that that's the model that our military should be pursuing right across the world?
I dare not say whether the British Army is actually making a profit. But one thing for sure, we in those days before 1997, we did require to pay for the stationing of the British naval force and military in Hong Kong. We pay for that. Of course, Hong Kong government has to separate a budget for our own security force to maintain law and order. But after 1997, the mainland government has given us a number of benefits, including not charging us for the stationing of the People's Liberation Army in Hong Kong. And indeed, the PRA, they are also, for those who have been traveling around Hong Kong, my best bet is it's not that easy to see a Chinese soldier around Hong Kong. You do not even see their vehicles often because they do not want to project their huge presence. So most of the time, they just confine themselves to garrison. And each year, they have an open day. And I can tell you, hundreds and thousands of people lined up because they find it a very mysterious place they want to go in and to take a look. And I can guarantee you one thing, only the best Chinese soldier could station in Hong Kong for a while, and then they will be on rotation. Some other new soldiers come in, and I think that's a good way for the Chinese government officials and the military to get to know our system as well.
To what extent over the last 10 years has Hong Kong suffered from the same problem that the U.S. has in that it has lost manufacturing?
Yeah. Indeed, we have lost the manufacturing industry some 30, 40 years ago. The next question is then, how do we cope with this? I mentioned specifically 30 years ago because around 79, that's the time when China practices open door policy. And that's also the time when lots of Hong Kong investors start shifting because of the labor cost reason, shifting their manufacturing base across the other side of the border. The situation continues. And as a result, in the past, the late 70s or 80s, we have almost lost all the low-cost manufacturing industries. As a matter of fact, 92% of the GDP in Hong Kong now comes from the servicing sector. Manufacturing sector only accounts for maybe like 2.5% and mostly in high value added products. So we import everything. And that's why we have a huge trade deficit with the US and many other economies. So how do we cope with this situation? There are only two ways. You resist it. You enact new laws prohibiting Hong Kong investments to go elsewhere. But that is, in our view, not the right way. And indeed, given a capitalist system in Hong Kong, there's no way that you can do it either. The day we stop capital inflow and outflow freely from Hong Kong out of Hong Kong, that's the end of Hong Kong's capitalist way of life. So we have done it the other way around. We upgrade our education system because Hong Kong has nothing, no natural resource like Alaska, but just people. So we invest a lot in education. Hong Kong's now has 12 degree awarding institutions, including three in the world's top 50s in the world. We also retrain our workers. We have to, it's sort of painful, but we have to tell them that you need to get retraining, without which you will not get any jobs. We do not want them to have any false illusion that they could continue to hold on their manufacturing jobs. And I think we succeed in doing that. It is not very easy restructuring, but I'm glad to say that this is the way Hong Kong works. And I think Hong Kong people is well known for its dynamism. So if this is not right, we shift to something else. And we shift from manufacturing industry to now a major servicing industry. But having said that, I must also add that we are now very cautious that having a a very small manufacturing base is not something that we like. And that's the reason why we are branching into some other areas, including innovation and technology.
Yes, thank you for your remarks. You mentioned the concerns about Hong Kong in 1997 and the commercial success since that time. But the one country, two systems yep. model has a time limit.
Yep.
And I was thinking as you were talking that in terms of the two systems on the capitalist front, the mainland Chinese have moved much more in the direction of open markets and the financial models yep. that you were describing. But there are other areas where there are definitely still two systems. And I wonder if you can discuss a little bit what you foresee in the next period since that first 15 years seems to have gone by so quickly.
Yep.
And since those other concerns are really important for investment as well as perceptions by the outside world.
Yeah, absolutely. As you rightly point out, this one country, two systems has a time span, 50 years. That's the promise by the mainland government. And indeed, when, as I said early on, many have skepticism at the beginning of this 50 years. And so far, it has been working very well. The 50-year guarantee will expire in 2047. I don't think I will be around to tell you whether it works or not. But one thing for sure, as you rightly point out, the system has been working successfully. And we all understand that China has some other territory in mind, Taiwan. Many said that they want to use Hong Kong and Macau as a model to show people that one country, two system actually work. And despite the changeover, people in Hong Kong and Macau can continue to practice their own way of life, their own legal system, the way of doing things, free flow of information and capital and people, somewhat different, indeed very different from the mainland. As you rightly point out, mainland is becoming, has continued to become more and more open and transparent. And we believe that this is perhaps most likely, and we welcome this approach in the next few decades. And we believe that this is, as long as the system is working and all the indications are that the system is working, there's no reason to question why the mainland will not continue this after 2047. Yeah, so I won't be able to tell you the answer. I don't have the crystal ball. But if you ask me for a bet, I would say that the system will continue to go beyond 2047. I mean, the one country, two system principle. And I think also, one thing is also very important. If you look at Hong Kong, one key difference between Hong Kong and the mainland is the legal system, the rule of law, and the independence of our judiciary system. My best bet is that it is part of Hong Kong's fabric. You change this, yes, you can, but this is no longer Hong Kong. Today, you start removing this special element from Hong Kong. The chance is that it is no longer Hong Kong. It is just another mainland city. And if so, what is the attraction of Hong Kong for our overseas investors? So I have very strong belief that Hong Kong will continue to maintain that characteristic, this special features, and it will be in China's interest to continue to do so.
Thank you. Before 97, there was a lot of people from Hong Kong immigrating to the West,
yes.
to Canada, and maybe you can talk a little bit about what happened to those people. Have some of them returned? And the other thing I wanted to ask you is, you talked about all the positive things have
yep.
occurred with the one country, two system rule. Can you talk about some of the negatives? What has really changed in a negative way in Hong Kong?
Thank you. Yep, sure. I I spent 3 years in Canada, right after 1997, working for the Hong Kong government as a director of the office, director of our Toronto office. So I think I'm in very good position to tell you the story. Over the 3 years period after 1997, to start with, yes, we had lots of skepticism on the implementation of one country, two systems. But as time goes on, people have greater faith. And I think because sometimes our professionals, our businessmen, when after their immigration to Canada or indeed to many other places, like the US or whatnot, some of them may continue to practice their profession. But for professionals like engineers, medical doctors, lawyers, they will have to go through the local qualification process, and some of them could not make it. So many of them, and because of the increasing confidence in Hong Kong's future, the implementation of one country, two systems, so lots of Canadians, lots of ex-Hong Kong citizens start moving back to Hong Kong. Indeed, not just from Canada, but also we see the same phenomenon from Australia, from UK, and from the US, all major destination of our Hong Kong immigrants. But when they return, we also found that they have create or generate some new business opportunities because of their presence overseas and because of their pursuit of education overseas and business and businesses overseas. So they widen. When they come back to Hong Kong, they bring with them lots of new connections, new expertise, new knowledge. That helps, again, Hong Kong to grow. This is something that we have never anticipated, but it's working very well. And of course, for those young Turks in Hong Kong around 97, the departure of this talent and experienced people also create a vacuum in Hong Kong. So all these young Turks, they got their promotion pretty quickly. Well, good for them. Going back to another question you raised, is there anything, are there major challenges in Hong Kong? I would say that it is, has nothing to do with the one implementation of one country, two systems, which has been working miraculously, to the surprise of many, I must admit. I think for Hong Kong, we have several major challenges. Number one, how to stay afloat. In those days, we talk about competition with other Asian dragons, you know, Singapore, Taiwan, you know, Malaysia. And in these days, there's less talk about these competitors. There are more talks about how do you face competition from Shanghai, Beijing, Shenzhen for that matter. The short answer is we are friendly competitors. There are things that we compete with one another, but there are also areas whereby we could collaborate. To cut a long story short, China being such a big country, there is room for growth for all. There could be many Hong Kongs, many Shanghais, many Beijings in China. But there are also some other problems. Our aging population, which means increasing expenditure on healthcare. So that is not going to be easy. And because of our Hong Kong, because of the Hong Kong dollar has been linked to the US dollar at a fixed exchange rate of one US dollar for 7.8 Hong Kong dollars since 1983, and it has remained unchanged since then. So basically, who is our financial secretary determining our interest rate, Hong Kong dollar interest rate? It's not our financial secretary, it's Chairman Bernanke out here. And you can imagine, the interest rate is very low in Hong Kong now, just like in the US. And as a result, we face another problem. Property market booming very quickly. Since early 2009, property market in Hong Kong, in terms of price, it has gone up by 43%. I don't know whether you have that rate of growth out here. Good for those, for the haves, but how about the have-nots? That is a critical issue for us. So we are implementing all measures to cool down the market. The last thing we want to see, we all understand that this property market bubble burst is one of the reasons leading to this financial crisis in the U.S. So this is something that we are very careful with. So there are the bright side, and there are also lots of challenges. But the government is thinking hard to deal with them, and so far we have some very good measures. But we are not complacent.
All right. Well, thank you, Commissioner Tong. We very much appreciate it. Yes, and as a gift to you for coming to Alaska and visiting us, we have a picture book with pictures from Alaska.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoy it, and we hope that you guys come back again sometime in the near future.
Thank you. Absolutely. And